Good morning again, Charlottesville. This is Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, your host for the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC. We're at 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are live here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. I'm joined in the studio by my producer, Kevin Chapman, and this morning we will be talking about the psychology of dieting and weight loss. Very important topic given the large increase in the number of obese Americans. Please join us and please join our discussion by visiting our Facebook page, Mind and Heart Show, where you can post a message. Or you can send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC. That's at MindHeartWPVC. You can email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. Send your questions or comments there. Or you may call us and join the discussion live. We're at 434-284-9470. We welcome all opinions and points of view. Only ground rule is that we maintain civility during our discussions. So before we get into the topic for today, quick check of the weather brought to you by the markets of Tiger Fuel. It is currently a chilly 34 degrees in Charlottesville, sunny. The winds are calm. We're looking at a high today of 56, excuse me. I think the temperature for kickoff today with UVA and Duke at Scott Stadium is, they're talking about 53 degrees and sunny. So grab a seat in the sunny part of the stadium. It's going to be a chilly game. And tomorrow we're looking again at a high of only 49, mostly sunny with no chance of precipitation. So this morning, we're going to talk about the psychology of dieting and weight loss, a very important topic. And I just wanted to start by giving a little context in terms of why this has become such a problem. I mean, certainly part of it is the ready availability of food, junk food, especially fast food, the changing eating habits. In America over the past several decades, we were much more reliant upon takeout and fast food, and those options are heavily marketed to us in terms of how we spend our food dollars. But thinking historically for a moment in terms of why we're predisposed to overeat, humans evolved during a time of relative scarcity. Our ancient ancestors, 100,000 or so years ago, were hunters and gatherers, and they were dependent upon whatever they could gather or kill to eat. And there may be periods of days or several days when they were unsuccessful. And so humans evolved to have a very strong appetite drive, because they had to live in times of some severe food shortages. So we have a very high drive hardwired to eat, quite simply. Now we live in a world where scarcity is not a problem, although it is certainly in other parts of the world and even in parts of our country, but food is relatively available, and there's a tendency to overeat, as there was 100,000 years ago when you weren't sure when your next meal might be. So we really are, the game is really stacked against us in terms of our tendency to overeat or eat more than we need to sustain ourselves, because we still eat as though we were living in a time of scarcity when we are not. You know, every day there's a new diet that's being promoted, either through a new book or talk shows or whatever. One of the recent ones was the paleo diet, and that was one which involved eating no dairy, no grains, no refined sugars, no processed foods. And it was an effort to approximate the diet of our ancient ancestors. And in fact, people have had some success losing weight with this diet. I have an acquaintance who lost about 15 pounds after 6 weeks of the paleo diet. The problem is it's a very restrictive diet, and once you stop the diet, it's highly likely that you will put the weight back on. The problem with restrictive diets is they create cravings, and then we think about food we want to eat. We tend to overeat once we've lost that weight. And very often, if you look at the data on dieting, yes, people initially lose weight, but they subsequently gain it back once they've stopped the diet because of pent up craving and just a tendency to again want to treat food as though there were a shortage when there is not. It's been estimated that at any point in time, 1 in 5 American adults are dieting, which is a striking statistic. The other thing that's interesting, that's 20% of our folks at any point in time, but it's also interesting that the vast majority of those folks, when followed, don't keep the weight off. Dieting in itself does not promote lasting weight loss. So what am I talking about when I say dieting? It's a pretty broad term. Well, I'm referring to any eating regimen that requires cutting portions or severely limiting calories or eliminating entire food groups, no carbs, no fats, no sweets, whatever. And again, these may be initially successful. The problem is, what's the rebound? What's the tendency to binge after we're done losing that 5 or 10 or 20 pounds? Diets tend to be fairly strict in dictating what we can and cannot eat, and that just sets up cravings for those foods that we've denied ourselves. They don't permanently change our behavior. They don't permanently change how we eat day to day. So I think if I would just say one thing, it would be, don't diet. I know that sounds unusual, but what I mean by that is, don't deprive yourself. Don't try eating very little. Don't try counting calories, because these strategies generally tend to backfire. The psychological effects of dieting are all too familiar to any of us that have dieted, and those include intense cravings for those foods that we've eliminated. Thinking about them, you know, I'm a chocolate fan, and if I deny myself that, I tend to really crave it and think about it quite a bit. We also tend to binge on junk food if we fall off the wagon, if we break our diet and undo all the benefit that we might have achieved while dieting. And again, there's an intense preoccupation with food when we are in a diet which is very limited or which denies us our favorite foods. And again, this, from an evolutionary perspective, that preoccupation with food with ancient man was important because it motivated them to go out and hunt or gather in order to feed themselves. But we no longer have to do that. So there's lots of research out there that shows the tendencies to undermine our diets because of these cravings and these bingings and the like. What we do know is that by making small changes to our eating patterns over time, that we can gradually lose the weight. So it requires a real lifestyle change, not depriving ourselves of major types of foods, not saying you can never have a chocolate again, but that you have to have it in moderation. It's really more about an overall lifestyle change rather than any kind of quick fix diet. The evidence on moderation is just too overwhelming to ignore. I mean, it's just very, very strong in terms of the studies. It's been estimated that at any time, two-thirds of Americans older than 20 are either overweight or obese. That's 66% of Americans over 20 are overweight or obese. And this brings with it multiple problems, including health problems, diabetes, heart disease, both of which are causes of death in the United States. So we really need to take a hard look at this and look at it in terms of what works and what doesn't work. So why do diets fail? Let's just talk about this a little bit, because there's a number of studies that have spelled out pretty clearly why diets typically fail. The first is what we call the what the hell effect. And this is that dieting usually leads to weight gain, not weight loss. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but there was a review of dieting studies in 2013 which showed that in 15 of the 20 studies that dieting predicted weight gain in adolescents and adults of normal weight. Because the problem is if while you're dieting you give in to one temptation, you're much more likely at that point to binge on food. That's why we call it the what the hell fact. Oh, I ate one cookie, I may as well eat the whole bag of cookies now that I've fallen off the wagon. And this really undermines our attempts to stay on the diet and lose the weight. There was a study in Canada looking at the effects on people who had broken their diet. And it was interesting because they split a group of folks into those who were dieting and those who were not. And all of the subjects in both groups received identical size slices of pizza. The folks who weren't dieting and the dieters who thought they were given a smaller, who were told they were given a smaller piece, smaller than usual, ended up eating a great deal more cookies than the folks that thought they had an adequate size portion. Again, sort of, well, my slice of pizza was small, so I can eat these cookies. Those that thought they had overeaten thought they'd already blown their diet. So again, thinking you've gone off your diet, eating an extra cookie will often cause us to abandon self-control to just the what the hell effect. Another problem with diets is that they cause us to have feelings of deprivation. You know, many of them say eliminate all carbs, eliminate all fats, whatever. The trouble is when we eliminate some of our favorite foods, we develop a deeper longing for them. The more we deprive ourselves, the stronger the urge to eat those foods. So, for instance, if we're going to avoid carbs and we're not going to have pasta, and pasta is one of my favorite dishes, then very often I'm going to be thinking about pasta a lot while I'm going through this diet. If I see a commercial or I'm in the store and see pasta, it's really going to ramp up my craving. We know that preoccupation with food is an inevitable result of dieting. That suppressing a thought, trying to suppress a thought, only makes it stronger. A social psychologist that used to teach at the University of Virginia, Daniel Wegener, did a series of experiments which he called the White Bear Experiments. You may be familiar with these. And he asked subjects to avoid all thoughts of a white bear. And guess what? That's all they could think about, because once the seed was planted, if I say to you, don't think of a white bear as I speak, you're probably doing just that. So again, as I've said, when we try to eliminate certain foods from our diet, we end up craving those very same foods. Not only do we crave those foods, that once we get access to them, we tend to overeat and eat more of them than we otherwise might. Those folks who restrict themselves report that they do have cravings and eat more than they otherwise would, whereas those who just simply monitored their snacks without creating deprivation did not have those same cravings or urges and tend not to have their diet backfire on them. So that's just an introduction. Please join us in the discussion. You're listening to the Mind and Heart Show with your host. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. We are here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 a.m., and we deal with all matters of the mind and heart, including mental health, stress, life transitions, parenting, sexuality, spirituality, and today we're talking about the psychology of dieting and weight loss. Please join us by visiting our Facebook page, Mind and Heart Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. You may send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC. You may email us at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. That's MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. Or call us and join the discussion at 434-284-9470. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We hope you're enjoying the show this morning. The reason we can bring you this show on WPVC is because of our program underwriters and because of listeners like you. Rather than pester you with annoying fund drives, we'd like to encourage you to go to our website, which is 947WPVC.org. 947WPVC.org, and find out how you can support the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville and help keep us on the air. Our topic today on the Mind and Heart Show is the psychology of weight loss and dieting, and we're talking about what does and doesn't work when we attempt to lose weight. As I mentioned a moment ago, two-thirds of Americans over the age of 20 are either overweight or obese, resulting in huge expenses medically in our culture for obesity-related disorders like heart disease, diabetes, and the like. And that there's just way too much fattening food available, and it's heavily marketed to us, and we tend to overeat as a result. Coming up on Thanksgiving, you know, this is a holiday when there's an abundance of food, and most of us do overeat. You know, the classic scenario of, you know, an hour after the meal, everybody sat down to watch the football game and fell asleep because they'd overeaten and really gorged themselves on Thanksgiving. So I felt this was a timely topic for this week, given that we're coming up on probably the biggest eating holiday of the year. So we were talking about some of the problems, some of the reasons that diets fail. We talked about the what the hell effect, where we eat, we break our diet with one cookie, and then we say what the hell, and then eat the whole box of cookies and end up gaining all the weight back. Another one of the reasons that diets fail is simply mental fatigue. You know, in order to diet, we have to put in a lot of attention. We have to do a lot of record keeping. We end up focusing a tremendous amount of energy on what we're eating, what we're not eating. You know, dieters get very preoccupied with thinking about food choices, either writing them down or trying to maintain them, trying to avoid temptation, trying to stay away from fattening foods. And so we can just wear ourselves down mentally in the course of a diet. And we overthink our food choices. Dieters often report that they don't think clearly. They're too consumed with thinking about food. Why did I eat that? What should I eat later to make up for that? What should I not eat later to make up for that? In a 2010 study, it was found that women who restricted their intake and recorded what they were eating exhibited elevated levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, a marker. Cortisol is a marker of biological stress. So it was clear that they were, compared to a group who wasn't monitoring, clearly more stressed in terms of just trying to pay attention to the diet and spend their time monitoring their food choices. So you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. My producer is Kevin Chapman, and we're here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. So please join us. The topic for today is the psychology of dieting and weight loss, a timely topic given that next week is Thanksgiving, the day in which most of us heavily overeat. So what should we do in terms of dieting? Well, let's talk about a few things. First is trying to adopt the right mindset to lose weight. We know that individuals who are preoccupied with their body image are less successful at losing weight. Folks with eating disorders who are preoccupied with their weight do very poorly in terms of dieting. They either starve themselves or overeat, or they binge and then they purge. And so we might want to begin with those folks by just getting them to address, perhaps through some therapy, their body image issues so that they no longer are so preoccupied. Now, that's easier said than done. The treatment of eating disorders can be very challenging, very difficult, and often be life-threatening if the person ends up eating so little that they put their health at risk. What I'd like to do now is share with you a podcast, and this is from Dr. Kelly Brownell, who's at Yale University, and he's probably one of the leading people in the country, or in the world for that matter, on the issues of psychology of weight loss. He's a psychologist there, and he runs a center, the Ross Center for, I'm not sure the name, I think it's the Ross Center for Weight Control or something to that effect. But Dr. Brownell is going to be interviewing a guest, and they'll be talking some about the psychology of weight loss. So let's listen to the podcast, and then we'll be back shortly and have some further discussion.
Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello, my name is Kelly Brownell. I'm the director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Our guest for today's podcast is Dr. Thomas Wadden, professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and leading authority on the treatment of obesity. Dr. Wadden, probably more than any person that I know, has done studies on a variety of treatments that range all the way from behavioral interventions to surgery, has been a noted national authority, international authority on these issues, having been president of the leading scientific organization, the Obesity Society, and highly regarded for his work. So, Tom, welcome.
Pleasure to be here today, Kelly.
So the treatment of obesity is a potentially pretty complicated topic because there's so many possible ways one might approach this. I mean, it used to be we didn't have many treatments, but now there are medications, there are behavior therapy approaches, there's surgery, and then there are aggressive diets. There are a lot of different things that have been done. And like I said, you have such a great overview of this. Let's start with sort of a broad question. If you're thinking about applying a treatment to somebody, how do you think through what the options are and what might work best?
Well, you start with the person's body weight and really look at what is their body mass index, which is just a measurement of your weight in relationship to your height. And so if somebody has a low body mass index in the range of 25 to 30, then that person probably is going to be fine just having a program of diet and physical activity and some lifestyle modification. And with that individual, hopefully he or she can try to lose weight on their own and can do so using basic principles. And probably the most important things are, first of all, just set a meal plan for yourself so that you're eating two or three times a day. You know when you're supposed to be eating, you know when you're not supposed to be eating. And the composition of the diet is not as critical for losing weight as is just reducing the amount of food that you eat. There's been so much debate over the past decade about, is it low carb, is it low fat? And in reality, I think after it was all said and done, the studies showed whatever you're eating, just eat less of it and you will lose weight. So that's the first thing, is just reduce the amount that you're eating, cut out fat, cut out sugar, and then try to increase your physical activity. And if you can get up to 30 minutes a day of walking, that is a great activity plan.
So let me ask you about this composition of the diet. That's a very interesting statement you just made, that it doesn't matter so much as long as you eat less of whatever you were eating before. Boy, there's been so much attention to the Atkins diet, all these other sort of diets come along, and they pick on imagine nutrients, say you've really got to do something special about this. They build a rationale for it. They try to explain the biology of it. So you'd think that one of these times somebody would get it right and they would pick the right nutrient or have the right diet. But it sounds like when it all comes out in the wash and you do these studies, that it's not the case.
Well, there's a very important study done by Dr. Frank Sachs at Harvard University with colleagues at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. And what they did was to show if you cut calories by 750 calories a day, the macronutrient composition doesn't make a difference for weight loss. So whether you're cutting out carbohydrate, cutting out fat, there is no difference in weight loss. Now, it's important to remember that it is possible that dietary composition makes a difference for control of health complications. So if you're somebody with type 2 diabetes, then you may, in fact, may want to increase your protein intake a little bit and decrease your intake of refined carbohydrates. So surprisingly, after all the research was done, it looked like a low-carb diet that's a little bit higher in protein and fat may have benefit for people who are trying to control type 2 diabetes. So I don't want to give the impression that dietary composition isn't important to health, but it turns out when you're losing weight, it's calories that count, not these magical macronutrients that people have been shouting about for the past decade.
You know, has anybody ever looked at the following question, that different people may have different problems with different sorts of foods, that some people may crave a lot of fat and that'll be the problem nutrient in their diet, and other people will be sugar, and that finding a diet that matches up to that might make sense?
Well, I think you put your finger on it, that given that calories count, that gives people a great latitude to find a diet that they find is compatible with their food preferences, their taste, palatability. And from that standpoint, find the diet that you like and that you can adhere to, and ultimately that's going to be the diet that works. There have been just numerous trials that have shown that you've got to find something that you can adhere to short-term and long-term if you're going to be successful with weight loss.
Okay. Let's talk about drugs. You know, drugs come down the road and there's a lot of excitement about them. They get introduced into the market, and this seems to be a pretty continuing process that's happened over the years. What's the current status of drug treatment for obesity?
Remarkably, there's been very little progress in drug therapy for obesity since 1999. That was the last time a medication was approved in the United States, and that was the medication Orlistat. Prior to that, in 1997, sibutramine was approved. Sibutramine is known as Meridia, and then Orlistat is known as Zenical. And despite all the attention to trying to find new weight loss medications, we haven't had anything for the past decade. A number of companies had invested in some drugs that block the cannabinoid receptor. That's a receptor that turns on your appetite, and this drug was going to block it. That medication turned out to be associated with negative psychiatric effects, so an increased risk of depression and suicidal ideation. So right now, where we were 10 years ago, and the drugs that we have, Meridia and Zenical, are effective, but they're modestly effective. They produce a weight loss of about 5% more than a program of diet and exercise. So somewhere between 3 to 5% greater weight loss. And the medications are expensive. They're about $100 a month. So there's not a whole lot of activity in weight loss medications currently. Probably the most popular medication is something called phentermine, which was part of the FenFen combination. That medication actually is effective and it's economical. There are three drugs on the horizon that will be going before the Food and Drug Administration in the next 6 to 12 months. They include one medication, which is putting together a drug called bupropion, which is already approved for depression and for smoking cessation, and it's being combined with naltrexone, a drug for alcoholism. So that drug is being tested. It produces, again, modest weight loss, but potentially could be a benefit. Another medication that's using phentermine in combination with something called topiramate. Topiramate is an anti-seizure drug. That approach has some exciting weight losses of about 10% or so of body weight. And then a third drug, which is looking at a medication that acts on the serotonin receptor in the brain and the hunger center. And that medication is effective, modestly again. So I think it's possible we'll have a new weight loss drug approved. Even if we do, however, the question still remains, who's going to pay for it? Because these medications are going to cost probably $3 to $5 a day. And in most cases, overweight individuals are asked to pay for those medications out of pocket. So that's going to be a barrier to their widespread use.
You know, it's so interesting that there are more drugs that have been introduced during that period of time since 1999, as you mentioned, because it's not for want of trying. The companies are spending tremendous amounts of money because the potential payoff could be enormous for them. Does that tell us anything about the causes of obesity? And I mean, is this a problem that has so many inputs and so many causes that you're just never going to find a single drug that would override all of them, and it's only likely to work for a subset of the pop? I mean, does that kind of philosophy make sense? Can we assume anything from the fact that these drugs keep coming along but produce disappointing results for the most part?
Well, you've put your finger on it, that when you're trying to modify the body's ability to regulate food intake and actually just to regulate weight, that you're coming up against problems. So anytime you try to influence a component of hunger and you can suppress that, that is overridden by another signal from another part of the brain. So as you can imagine, we've evolved, so we're exquisitely sensitive to making sure that we eat enough to stay alive. And so anything that is suppressing hunger signals potentially is going to be overridden in another part of the brain. It's like playing whack-a-mole. You sort of suppress one thing here, and it pops up in another area of the brain. So that's made it very difficult. Beyond that, I think we end up with the problem that no matter what drug you provide people that's going to be effective, it still is going to have to compete with what you have described as the toxic food environment. So you can put everybody on a medication, but if you're still exposing them to huge portions of food, high fat, high sugar foods, encouraging them to eat 24 hours a day, there's no drug in the world that's going to be able to overcome the toxic food environment. So in order to truly be able to see the true benefit of medication, you're going to still have to try to change that food environment that is eliciting all of this desire to eat in people.
So you painted a very interesting and important picture here, that the environment bears down on people, and then there are biological adaptations that occur when people lose weight. And for the people listening to this podcast, one of our previous visitors was Dr. Rudolf Leibel from Columbia University, who's done a tremendous amount of interesting work on that very topic about what the body does as people are losing weight and how it becomes hard to lose weight because the body adapts and fights off the weight loss and things. So between the environmental barriers and the biological barriers, I mean, could you make an argument it's futile to try to treat obesity? I mean, do you think we're still making progress, or do you think we stand with that?
Well, I think we are making progress on the treatment of obesity. It would be facilitated by a couple of things. One is we'd have far greater progress if we could change the food environment and the physical activity environment. That's going to make all these treatments more effective. And then I think if we can start to target changes in brain activities in response to dieting, which Dr. Leibel has talked so much about, that is going to be a big help. So Dr. Rudy Leibel that you mentioned has shown that when you go on a diet and you restrict your calories and you lose weight, you have a big drop in a hormone called leptin. And leptin causes a reduction in the number of calories that the body needs to maintain its basic function. So your resting metabolic rate drops about 10%, and then the energy you expend during physical activity drops about 30 to 40%. And Dr. Leibel has shown if you give people leptin, if you can give them exogenous leptin, you can normalize this sort of energy efficiency that occurs with dieting. So I think that's where we're going to see some progress, when you can really develop treatments that target the complication that's being developed as a result of dieting.
Well, good. That's a little more hopeful, which is nice.
It is a little bit more hopeful. And the reality also is that people can lose weight if they can just change their personal food environment. I mean, we live in an environment, again, where we're encouraged to eat all the time. But if you somehow can make a personal environment where you keep all these high-fat, high-sugar foods at arm's length, you'll be able to lose weight. It takes more effort. We wish we could make it easier for people to do it, but it can be done.
Let's talk for a moment about surgery. More and more people are having surgery for obesity. And I know over the years the techniques have been greatly improved and refined. What's the current status of work on surgery for obesity, and what sort of techniques are being used now? What kind of weight losses are you seeing?
Well, first, surgery has grown in popularity. In this past year, 2009, I think that there are approximately 250,000 bariatric surgery procedures conducted. There has been enormous growth in the interest in something called laparoscopic adjustable banding, and that's where you go right below the esophagus at the top of the stomach, and you literally put a band around the stomach, and you create a little pouch of about the size of 1 ounce. And what that pouch does is it makes it impossible to eat a large amount of food, as you might expect. It doesn't change any of the digestive processes. It just decreases the amount that you can eat. In this lap band, as it's sometimes called, that's a specific type of procedure, produces a weight loss of about 20% of initial body weight over a two-year period.
So that's double what the best drugs would do.
That's exactly right. So the best drugs, the best lifestyle program does about a 10% weight loss. So it produces about a 20% loss. It's been very popular. I've been astounded to be watching television and now see ads for the lap band, and to be seeing all these billboards for it as well. So it's definitely here. Now, the problem is that in some cases, the lap band is ineffective because people are able to expand their pouch over time. Sometimes the band slips. It needs to be reoperated. So in 30 to 40% of cases, people are not going to get the result that they want 2 or 3 years later after the procedure has been done. The old gold standard operation is still the gastric bypass. In this case, you again create a small pouch below the esophagus, and then you take a limb of intestine, the jejunum, you attach it to this little pouch, and the food bypasses the stomach. And this operation seems to be more durable in terms of it produces a weight loss of about 30% of initial body weight, and the weight loss is sustained fairly well, so that at 2 to 3 years after you've had the operation, you'll probably have a loss of about 25%. The most striking thing that people are finding today is that this operation actually changes body weight regulation. And by that I mean there are hormones that it affects, so that it lets you feel less hungry. It decreases a hormone called ghrelin that's produced by the stomach. So it quiets that down so you don't have hunger. And it also helps with other hormones that are associated with satiety, something called GLP-1. So I think you're going to see more attention to gastric bypass, and in particular, you're going to see attention to it as a means of controlling type 2 diabetes, that people who have gastric bypass have about a 90% remission of type 2 diabetes, and it happens very quickly.
Pretty remarkable.
Pretty remarkable, and the surgeons, as you might imagine, feel like, well, currently, the criteria say you have to have a body mass index of 40, which is about 100% over your ideal weight.
So you double your ideal weight.
Yeah, double your ideal weight. Or if you have a health complication, maybe a body mass index of 35, the surgeons would like to say, well, if you have type 2 diabetes, you should be eligible for gastric bypass no matter what your degree of overweight, since it helps you so much control your diabetes. So a lot of interest and a lot of activity in this area.
There have been some studies, haven't there, on the cost effectiveness of surgery and whether it's not an insignificant investment to have the surgery done. In fact, I don't know if you know what it costs these days, but it'd be interesting to hear what it is. But there have been some studies, as I recall, on how well that pays for itself.
Yeah, well, let's talk about two things. First, there's a landmark study that was done in Sweden that showed that people who had weight loss achieved with surgery actually did reduce their all-cause mortality. So they reduced their risk of death by about 24% over a 15-year period. So that's the strongest evidence to date that losing weight is good for you. We've always known that being overweight, obese, is bad for your health, but this is the first evidence that really shows that losing weight is good for your health. But the question about the cost of it is an important one. To have a bariatric procedure such as gastric bypass, the cost currently is about $25,000. For a lap band, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $20,000. So it's a major investment. And from what I understand, these costs are not recouped for many years. You're going to find that people who have had either of these procedures are coming back into hospital to have adjustments or to have complications treated. And so you don't find cost savings for many years down the road. It's going to be probably 10 to 15 years before you really see the cost benefit.
That creates a problem for the health insurers, doesn't it? Because so often people who are a part of one health insurance plan will move to another because they move to a different place or get a new job. So investing in the surgery today, if it's not going to pay off for 10, 15, 20 years, then there's less incentive to cover that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I think their feeling is, why don't you go join a new health plan and let them pay the $25,000? I have been impressed by the extent to which health plans are paying for bariatric surgery. It's shocking and perverse in some ways. I evaluate people for bariatric surgery to make sure that they are psychologically appropriate for it. And I now have people come in all the time and I'll say, well, have you tried Weight Watchers or another less invasive procedure? And they'll say, well, no, I can't afford Weight Watchers, but I can afford surgery.
Oh, because of the
and
coverage.
So at this point, insurance is covering bariatric surgery at a cost of $25,000, but they won't pay for a Weight Watchers meeting at a cost of $14 a week. And that in my mind, is rather perverse. You would like to try a less intensive intervention first. To the credit of the insurance group, they are looking at the evidence, and the evidence is that bariatric surgery, particularly this Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, does produce long-term weight loss and good remission of health complications.
So this may be a hard question to answer, but is there any way to use a crystal ball and look ahead? If you could project ahead 10 years, let's say, about what the treatment of obesity will look like, where do you think the advances are likely to come? Do you think there'll be drug advances? Do you think surgery will get better? Where do you think the excitement is going to be?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you had asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said a lot of things, and here we'd be sitting, and not much would have changed except for surgery. So I do think we're going to continue to see developments in surgery. I think there will be new medications, but I don't think the medications are going to have the impact that consumers, dieters would like them to have. There is not going to be a magic bullet. We know, again, from work by Rudy Leibel and individuals like him, that anytime you find a drug that's going to produce big weight loss, you are going to have these compensatory biological changes that fight against your body losing weight. I think that the advances are going to come in more subtle ways, and specifically, I think that we're going to see greater efforts to rein in the toxic environment, as your group here at Yale is trying to do, and that really has just caught fire. I mean, there's so much going on just at a grassroots level now in terms of trying to decrease the consumption of sodas and high-fat, high-sugar foods. So that's going to make the backdrop more effective, more minimal to weight control. And then I think that we will probably see a greater availability of lifestyle modification being delivered to people in community settings, whether it's going to be in schools, libraries, YMCAs, and you're going to see a lot of dissemination through probably smartphones, that you'll be able to get a weight loss program on your smartphone. You already can, and that could give people a lot of help in that regard. So it's going to be probably a breakthrough more in the methods of delivering treatment than it is any new breakthrough. And, well, here's a new way to eat less and exercise more. If we're going to have breakthroughs in pharmacologic treatment, I think it's going to be in the areas that come about from Rudy Leibel's work, where people who have severe obesity may have leptin replacement therapy to correct the deficits that are created by dieting. And it's possible we'll have new combination therapies that can address some of these compensatory changes that prevent you from losing as much weight as you want. So that's the crystal ball, but I think it's going to be modest improvement, incremental improvement, rather than these breakthroughs per se.
Good. Well, at least there's some improvement on the horizon, which is very nice. So thanks so much for sharing this. It was a terrific overview of this complicated topic.
Thank you, Kelly.
So our guest today was Dr. Thomas Wadden, professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and noted expert on the treatment of obesity. Please visit our website at www.yalerudcenter.org for a list of resources on food and food policy issues, an email newsletter that gets dispatched at no cost monthly, and then also a list of other excellent podcasts that we've recorded. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. I'm your host for the Mind and Heart Show on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Our topic today is the psychology of dieting and weight loss, a timely topic with Thanksgiving coming next week. We just heard a podcast interview by Dr. Kelly Brownell, who's one of the world's leading experts on the subject. I think he illuminated some of the points that we had made earlier today. I want to remind you that we now, if you've just joined us or missed the show or want to listen to it again, the show will be available on CVillePodcast.com. That's a clearinghouse here locally for various podcasts. That's CVILLE Podcast, PODCAST.com. One word, CVillePodcast.com. So please check us out on there if you haven't been able to follow the whole show today. I want to hear it again. Got an email a moment ago from a listener who said, my problem is salty snacks like potato chips. I buy a bag thinking I'll eat just one and then typically eat the whole bag. How can I manage this behavior? You know, going back to what we said earlier, the reason you probably eat the whole bag is because you've created a state of deprivation with regard to that particular salty, greasy snack. And we often binge in response to feeling deprived, and you probably think a lot about potato chips or Fritos or whatever. What I would suggest is that you set a quota, if you will. You might allow yourself 5 potato chips twice a day or whatever, and you have to be mindful that that's what you're going to do. So you open the bag, you set 5 potato chips aside, you seal the bag up, and then very slowly and carefully and with great satisfaction, eat those 5 potato chips and then get up and do some other activity. But you have to be very focused, very mindful, and what we're trying to do there is not create that sense of scarcity or deprivation, but rather allow you to enjoy the some of the potato chips without binging on them and undermining any attempts to lose weight. So we were talking about what works. What works is simple, slow, and steady, meaning no grand, quick, fasting weight loss of all the many diets out there, but just changing behavior, changing how much we eat, the speed with which we eat, how often we eat, what we eat. We don't deprive ourselves, but we eat in moderation when it comes to high-caloric foods, potato chips, sweets, desserts, and the like. I said earlier that I'm a person that just loves chocolate, and I have to limit myself to 2 or 3 small pieces of chocolate a day, or I'll just eat the whole bag. And not only do I gain weight there, but I also probably make myself sick from eating way too much chocolate. So let's say you want to lose anywhere from 5 to 50 pounds. Again, moderate weight loss. Slow, simple, and steady. Simple, gradual change is the best way to promote lasting weight loss. We know this. There is no magic bullet. The magic diets where you drop 15 pounds with the paleo diet usually backfires. We come off those diets. We've got all these pent-up cravings, tend to overeat, to indulge, and gain the weight right back. of the available diets out there, and you just heard Dr. Brownell talk about this, Weight Watchers is probably the one with the most success, with the most sensible plan. It involves a lot of things that really work. Again, no foods are off limits. You're eating 3 balanced meals a day. It does highlight fruits and vegetables, but it also doesn't skimp on meats and other foods you might prefer. The other thing I really like about Weight Watchers is the peer support and the group advice. You know, it's really so much easier to lose weight when you have a support group than when not. And what happens with Weight Watchers is you go to the meetings, you weigh in, you get a tremendous amount of group support. Some people find the group weigh-ins counterproductive. They feel if they haven't met their goal, then they're disappointed themselves, that the group is disappointed. But that's a minor drawback. I think overall, people that get on Weight Watchers and stay on Weight Watchers, they have a very user-friendly point system. When you go to the grocery store, many of the foods you pick up will give you the Weight Watcher points for that particular item or that particular food. And so they've really done a good job. The other thing I like about Weight Watchers is that they really rely on current research. Over the years, certainly over my years as a psychologist, and what I know about Weight Watchers, they keep evolving. And they incorporate research such as Dr. Brownell does at Yale and others around the country to update their system and make it more consistent with what we know works and staying away from what does not work. Other more extreme diets that we talked about earlier, the paleo, the low carb, the Atkins fasting, juice fasting. Again, you will lose weight. The problem is you're going to get it back. It's a high probability you're going to gain it back. That all of the research says that that's the main problem. Now, the final thing I want to mention, because it's also critically important, I think, is the role of exercise. You know, exercise is not only important for all-around health, it is critical to a sustained weight loss, to have a regular pattern of sensible eating and a regular form of weekly exercise. That a number of studies show that it's been that exercise that raises your heart rate, break a sweat, is really important to maintaining weight loss on a number of levels, including that when we work out vigorously, we may be actually less hungry in terms of raising our metabolism than when we were just being sedentary. So, as with Weight Watchers, having a buddy can be really important in terms of exercise. Someone you're going to meet at the gym or go walking with or go running with. There are many benefits from exercise, and weight loss is certainly one of them. There are studies that suggest that vigorous exercise causes a lessening of the brain's reaction to those pleasurable foods. There's certain hormones and neurotransmitters that are released during exercises that are all also conducive to losing weight. So we're just about done for today. If you want to listen, if you didn't hear the entire show, you can go to SeavillePodcast.com. I want to mention that next week, Saturday after Thanksgiving, I'm very pleased to have a guest joining me, Dr. Russell Fetterman, who is an expert on bipolar illness, and we'll be talking about that at some length. So please join our discussion next week, and enjoy your weeks and stay safe. Thanks.